نعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وبه نستعين لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله إلا بالله العلي العظيم والحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين خاتم النبيين سيدنا ونبينا وحبيب قلوبنا وشفيع نفوسنا وطبيب ذنوبنا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد
اللهم صل على محمد وعلى محمد
ثم الصلاة والسلام على أهل البيت الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين ولعنة الله على أعدائهم أجمعين من الأولين والآخرين إلى قيام يوم الدين رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واهلل عقدة من لساني يفقهوا قولي أما بعد فقد قال الله سبحانه وتبارك وتعالى في كتاب المبين بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم ولقد بعثنا في كل أمة رسولا إن اعبدوا الله والله واجتنبوا الطاغوت صدق الله العلي العظيم صلوات على محمد وعلى محمد
اللهم صل على محمد وعلى محمد
الله عليه الصلوات
اللهم صل على
Dear brothers and sisters in Islam and Iman, Assalamu alaikum, Jamian, wa rahmatullahi wa
barakatuh.
We begin in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. All praise, all thanks, all glory is only for Him and for none else. He is without master, without helper. There is none equal to Him, and everything is below Him. We're continuing our series titled From Muslim to Mu'min. And our job for the rest of Muharram, for these next 10 nights, for the full 12 nights actually, is to go through the usul al-deen, those fundamentals that we all have to believe in as Muslims, but to get a different understanding, to get yaqeen, meaning we have to be certain in these things, so that's how we can build our iman. Because if we build iman, once we have that iman, then we'll finally have that energy not to disobey Allah anymore. So our first fundamental, our first rule of religion that we went through was what? Was Tawheed. We proved the oneness of Allah. And we proved that He is the creator of everything, that He has knowledge over everything, and that everything continues to exist, and it would not exist if it wasn't for Him. So from Tawheed, then we moved on to Adalat. And then we tried to prove that Allah is just, and that we have a sense of justice in us as well. Because without justice, then we won't trust Allah. Without trusting what Allah tells us, then we won't obey what He says. And we'll just disobey Him. So we went through the proofs of justice a few nights ago as well. And then we continued on. And last night we went over good and evil. And we said that we know that Allah is one, that He is all-powerful, that He is just. But how are we supposed to understand all those things that happen to us which are evil, which we think are bad? So we went through some proofs last night and we figured out that anything that comes out of Allah is always pure, it's always good. It's only us that thinks that something is unjust or evil. So as Allah said, that injustice only comes from when we do something wrong, when we disobey Allah, or if we don't understand what He's doing. So that's what injustice is. So now we have an understanding that Allah is one, that He's just, and that He only can do good to us. So where do we go from there? So now some of us might have a little bit more energy, now that we're more willing to, okay, I want to obey Allah now. I understand He's just, but what is He telling me to do? Where am I going to find out how to be a good Muslim? Where am I going to find out how to be a good mu'min? So what does Allah tell us? He says in chapter 16, verse 36, we had sent for every nation a prophet. And what was the reason for this? And he continues and says that the prophets came down for Abdullah to teach us how to worship Allah, how to become Abdullah, how to be a slave, a true servant of Allah. And also to for Wajtanibu Tawhud, to keep away from anything that's Tawhud. Tawhud is, I guess the basic definition would be anything that we consider to be a god, which shouldn't be a god. So the prophets came to teach us what Allah is, how to worship Him, and to keep away from worshiping anything else except for Allah. So some questions might come to our mind. Do we need prophets? Yes. And we had said the other day, yeah, right, we do, but some people think that we don't. And why do they think this? Well, we had said the other day that Allah put this idea of justice in everybody. So we know some basic idea of good and evil. No matter what religion a person is born into, even if they're somebody who doesn't believe in God at all, they still think that, you know, lying is bad. They still think that murder is not a good idea. Or, you know, crime is stealing, anything. Most of these general rules, everybody agrees that, okay, we agree that this is not good. So then they say that since we all know what's good and bad already, Allah already put this in us, why do we need to follow some prophet? Why do we have to follow a person? So this is what they say. So how are we going to answer them? It's true that God did put into our brain, our heart, our soul, there is an idea of basic good and evil. So let's say that one person says, well, I understand that, you know, killing somebody is not a good idea. Well, what about somebody like Saddam Hussein? Or what about somebody like Yazid? Or Umar bin Saad? Or anybody who is a murderer? What do we do with them? How are we going to punish them? If someone says, well, I think that God tells us that we shouldn't murder anybody at all, but somebody else says, well, we have to murder the murderers, otherwise they'll be killing everybody. So, if it's up to us, then we're going to have disagreements. So we ourselves have some basic information so we can't go completely off the course, so we don't go running around murdering and stealing and cheating. But for specific things, we need to figure out what is Allah telling us to do. Because if we try to figure it out on our own, then we're all going to disagree. So we need to have that same idea. We need to have a central point to go to get Allah's teachings for us. And some other examples that we'll run into in our daily lives. Some people think that music is okay. Like, well, it doesn't hurt anybody. I listen to it, it doesn't hurt any person at all. And some people even say, when I listen to music, it actually gets me closer to God. This is what some people think. But we know in Islam, music, you know, haram music, it's not allowed. And this is, you know, a basic teaching of us. But some people, they make decisions on their own rather than finding out what does Allah command from us? What does He want from us? What does He say? And again, we mentioned punishing criminals. Some people in the West, for example, say that the way that Muslims handle crime and punishment is barbaric. We do things like, you know, ancient style. For example, in Islam, there's a punishment for a thief that, you know, you have to cut off his fingers if he steals. After he goes through a trial and everything, of course, you can't just come and cut off somebody's fingers. But there's a trial, and if they're proven guilty and they don't repent, then the fingers have to be cut off. Now, some people, again, in the West, they always say Muslims are crazy because they cut people's fingers off. So who's right? Are we right or are they right? We say we're going to God. But even people who are Jewish or Christian or, you know, just good people, that's what they say. They say, no. No matter what, God can't say this. It's too evil. It doesn't sound right to cut somebody's fingers off. So we have to figure out, there has to be one message that comes from God. There can't be different messages. Because, like we said before, if there were different messages, if everybody got to say whatever they wanted, if they had different opinions, then everybody would end up in chaos. Murderers could do whatever they want. There'd be no sense of government and order. And crime and punishment would have no sense of justice in the world. And remember, one of the basic pillars of Islam was that we trust Allah, that we have the sense of justice, that people should get what they deserve. If you do bad, you have to get punished. And if you do good, you should get a reward. So Allah, since He's not unjust, has to make sure that all of this stuff happens in this dunya too. So this is why we have to send these prophets. So Allah also continues and tells us one of the reasons that He sends the prophets. In chapter 4, verse 165, He says, "We sent messengers for two things, to give you good news and to give you a warning." So what's the good news and what's the warning? The good news is simple. If you obey what I'm saying and what the Prophet is telling you, which is from Allah, then you get rewards in this world and in the next world. You end up in paradise. And then there's a warning. If you keep disobeying Allah and you don't change your ways, you're going to end up in, you know, a bad situation in this world. And then once you end up in the next world, you'll be in hell. So this is the first job of the Prophets, to tell people, as long as you obey God, you're good to go. But if you start disobeying Him, then you're going to have problems. And then Allah continues in this verse that He sends them for good news and a warning so that people can't complain to Allah after the messengers come. And verily, Allah is Aziz and Hakim. He's wise and mighty. So, again, if we didn't have prophets that came down from Allah, and let's say that, you know, we were trying to be good mu'min, good Muslims, and one person again said, well, I think we should listen to music. And somebody else said, well, I don't think we should listen to music. One person said, well, I think men and women should all be in the same place. And somebody else said, well, we can keep them separate. If we just keep disagreeing on everything, then we'll never be able to move forward. We'll never have one way of working on it. And then in the Day of Judgment, We'll complain to Allah. Say, Allah, you never told us what the right way was, so you can't hold us accountable. You can't punish us because you never taught us. But this is why Allah is saying, I did send you prophets. I told you exactly what was clear. And even in our hadith right now, the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, has said that the laws of Islam are completely clear, 100%. What is supposed to be halal, I've told you what's halal. What's haram, I've laid down for you what's haram. Allah has put this down. Whatever is in between, what seems a little bit gray, the best thing for a Muslim, the best thing for a mu'min, the best thing for a real Shia to do is to practice ihtiyat, which means be precautionary. You know, be careful. If, for example, somebody tells you, well, I think this thing is, it's okay to do, it's halal. And somebody else says, no, I'm pretty sure it's haram. So you have two different opinions and you're not sure. The best thing that the Prophet is saying to do is, you know, practice precaution. It's better to keep away from it. Because you might end up getting punished for it later. There's no point if you have to. So, now, why is it that we can't learn how to practice these laws? Because there are some people who now, even they call themselves Muslims. They say, okay, I understand that the prophets came down, but they were hundreds and hundreds of years ago, and thousands of years ago. You know, they came so long ago, it's a different time now. We have different things. So, they didn't tell us about, you know, the internet. They didn't tell us about Facebook. They didn't tell us about video games. They didn't say things about smoking and, you know, shisha and all these new things that come up. They didn't mention this, so we have to figure it out on our own. But one thing we have to realize is, like we mentioned the other day, humans are arrogant. What does that mean? Is that even with a little bit of knowledge, we feel like we know everything in the world. And that's not true. Remember, we had proved the other day in our discussion on justice that sometimes when we think something is bad, it actually ends up being good. But because we see it in such a short amount of time, because we're limited in our scope of time, we don't see the full wisdom behind it. So what Allah is trying to let us know is He has to send people who have the full knowledge that Allah gives to them for all people of all times. Not just the people of that time, and not just the people of the future. So how is He supposed to do that? Well, let's give an example first so that we can understand this idea better. If you send a loud salawat.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad.
So let's say we get an assignment from our teacher in class, or college, whatever. So it's a project that you have to work on with a bunch of students, you know, a bunch of people in your class. So you get home, you guys meet up at the library or something, and you start discussing what the project is. And, you know, there's differences of opinion. One guy says, all right, we have to go to the internet to find resources about how to do this report. And somebody else in your group says, no, the teacher said that we can't do that, we can only use books. And somebody else says, no, the teacher said books and internet. And you guys just sit there and you argue the whole time, like, all right, what are we supposed to do then? But one person says, listen, the teacher has given me the rules, and he's told me this is how we have to do the project. So I have written down from him, this is how we're supposed to complete the project. So now it's up to everybody else that he has the rules from the teacher. They can either listen to him or they can go with whatever they think is correct. So the whole point of this analogy is to understand, Allah is the one who has the knowledge of what is right and what's wrong. He's given it to the prophets, and the prophets are our indirect teachers basically. They're representatives of Allah. So when He sends them down, this is where we get our teachings from. Allah would be unjust, and He'd be doing an injustice to everybody if He didn't give us the clear laws for every single situation in life. So whenever people say that, well, Allah left it to us to do, that's incorrect. What you're saying is that something that is happening today is outside of Allah's knowledge, which is impossible, as we proved in the first, you know, lectures. Creation, the way we are today, means Allah has to know what's going on. That's the only, you know, explanation. So in order Allah, since Allah is not unjust, He has to have put down every law for any situation. But it's up to us to go out and do the research for that. But again, that depends on if you have the willpower, if you want to be Shia, if you want to be Mu'mineen, then you're going to have to spend some time in your day to go out and read these laws. And that's why we wanted to spend some time in the lectures to go through Ahkam, the Hukum of Allah, the rules, so that we don't get caught up in doing what's wrong, disobeying Allah accidentally. So this is going to be a very, very, you know, we're going to end this discussion today. It's very, very short. And we're going to move on to a deeper understanding tomorrow. Today, all we wanted to do was just to get an understanding that, like we had said the other day, we can't understand everything that's in front of us. No matter how many books we read, no matter how much school we do, even PhDs, you know, doctors, no matter how much experience that we get in life, we are never going to have enough knowledge to know everything, right? So this is why Allah has to give us every law for every situation. So this is why we have to turn to our religion, which answers all these questions. And one of our great Muslim philosophers has said it best, actually. He says that the needs of the human being for sending down prophets, for our survival, and moving towards perfection is greater than their need for eyelashes. It's greater than their need for eyebrows. It's greater than their need for feet. So it's impossible for God to not, you know, to give you feet, to give you eyes, and to give you ears, to give you intellect, but to not give you the way of, you know, being a better Muslim. So this is just a logical proof that this one philosopher went through. So now we just want to go through a few laws, inshallah. We have been continuing our discussion on najasat and tahara, on what's impure and what's pure. So we had mentioned all the things that were najis, and we had also mentioned that the only way that a person becomes najis is if either the thing that's najis is wet, or your hand or your body is wet. So if wetness transfers, then najas will take place. Then you'll be najis. So one thing that happens to us in the West that a lot of us forget about is leather. Now who knows what leather is? I forgot. That's leather.
Kind of something made from animal skin.
Yeah, something from animal skin. Huh? Anybody else want to add anything? Yeah.
It's mostly cowhide.
So is leather allowed for us to wear or not?
Yes.
But it's coming from an animal. I thought we couldn't wear animal stuff.
It has to be slaughtered halal.
Very good, that's awesome. Very good. Okay. So if the animal is slaughtered, if it's the biha, if it's been slaughtered according to the Islamic laws, then we can wear it with no problem. And you can even touch it with your wet hands. So this is why people will go out of their way and buy, you know, the biha leather belts, or they'll buy the biha leather wallets or jackets, etc., etc. So that way, if they, you know, have wet hands after they make wudu or they wash their hands or something, even if they touch it, they're still okay. But what about in the West? Most of the leather that we get here is not from, you know, Muslim farms, right? So the stuff's not the biha. So then what are we going to do? We have to clean it, right? But because it's from a najis animal, because the skin is najis for us, you can never clean something that's najis. All you can do is, if you become najis from touching it with your wet hand, then you have to wash yourself. And like we mentioned yesterday, based on precaution, the best thing to do is make sure you wash yourself 3 times, just in case. So the other thing we need to make sure is, what are some common things that we come in contact to with every day that are made of leather? Yes?
Car seats.
Car seats, very good. What else?
Belts.
Belts, yeah. Mm-hmm. Shoes. Yeah. Jackets, yeah. Mm-hmm. Wallets, right? You stole my answers. I said leather, but okay, go ahead.
The cell phone holders.
Yeah, they're leather too, right? Yeah, okay, good. Wallets, yeah. Anything else?
Yeah.
Hats are, yeah, leather. I don't know who wear leather hats still. I think they're out of style, right? Yeah?
Gloves,
yeah, leather gloves. Okay, I think there's more? No?
No.
I think we're done. I think we're out of everything leather. Okay. So, again, we're allowed, even if it's not the biha, even if it's not a Muslim wallet or a Muslim hat or Muslim, you know, glove or belt, we're still allowed to wear it. It's no problem. One thing we have to be careful if we're praying. If we have a belt on or we have a wallet in our pocket, some of our scholars say that you can't have this stuff all in you while you pray. Some do, but some don't. So we should get in the habit of, you know, taking two roads. Either one choice is that you make sure that every piece of leather that you have comes from a Muslim source. And there's websites available where you can do this. You know, some of us have family members that go to Pakistan all the time, or India. You can get the stuff from there. Or if you have family members in Iran or Iraq or wherever you're from, if they're from a Muslim country, have them pick it up and bring it back for you. Or, again, like we said, there's plenty of websites available. You can look online, ask your parents to help you, and order this stuff online. Get yourself a belt, a hat, whatever. Now the other option is, let's say that, alright, I looked online and every Muslim belt is really, really ugly. I don't like the way it looks. I like Calvin Klein gloves. I like this bag. You know, okay, fine. That's okay. You want to be in style? That's no problem. We just have to make sure that we're not najis when we're praying. Or, I mean, you can be najis, but obviously you can't pray when you're najis. But, again, as a precautionary thing, we don't want to be in a state of najasat at all. So, again, if we come to contact with these things, we need to make sure that as soon as it happens, we go wash ourselves off. So, if it's raining, for example, like it's been doing for the past few days, so alhamdulillah hasn't for the past 2 days, but you know, a few days ago it was raining, and many of us have leather car seats. Now, there are certain leather car seats that are made in Muslim countries, but sometimes we don't know if they are. And since we're living in the West, most of the stuff is produced here. And since it's produced from the animals here, they're not dhabiha, right? They're not slaughtered according to Islamic rules. So if that's the case, one thing we should do is, in your trunks, a good thing is keep a cloth or a towel, you know, some sheet. So that way if it does rain, you put that sheet down on your seats, you know, when you get in the car. That way, you're not touching your seats, so none of your clothes will become najis. But let's say by accident, you end up sitting on your seat, or, you know, your foot touches your leather shoe after it's wet, you know, something like that happens. Sometimes you can't avoid it. What you should do then is immediately, so you don't forget, go and wash it off right away. Make sure we should also try to keep a water bottle in our car. You know, not just for drinking, but for, you know, emergency situations. Like, you know, you have to, sometimes we on the road, we have to use the bathroom. We need that water. Or if you have to purify yourself, you know, from the jasab. Or if you have to make wudu. It's always good to have this kind of, you know, spare water with you. So inshallah, if our parents don't already do that, let's remind them that, you know, mom, dad, let's keep this spare stuff in our car. Keep like an empty gallon of water, you know, fill it up and keep it in the back or something. Just so that we don't run into these situations. So, if there's no questions about najasat, about leather, then we'll move on to one more fiqh issue. Yes?
What about leather that's coated? Sometimes they seal it with stuff. Is it still, when it gets wet, do you still get najis?
Leather that's coated?
It's most leathers and car seats and stuff is sealed leather. So it doesn't absorb the water as such. Are you still, if with your wet hand you're touching the leather seat, do you get najis?
I've never read that ruling myself, so I couldn't answer you. Inshallah, does anybody else know the ruling for that? No. What I'll do, inshallah, is I'll ask my teacher. I'll see if I can find it in the books, and then I'll let everybody know tomorrow, inshallah. But a general rule for najasat and barriers, as it's listed in the books, is that if there's a barrier, like if you're actually not touching the najis thing itself, if you're, you know, you being wet, don't touch the physical thing that's najis, then you're okay. But the question is whether that, you know, the cover that's on that leather, however it's bound or, you know, set up, if it's a barrier or not. That, again, I'm not sure, so I'd have to look that up. So inshallah, I'll do that. But that's a very good question. So if there's no other questions, then one other thing we want to do before we move on to the next part of the speech is we just want to go quickly over wudu. So I'm going to ask you guys, what's the first part of wudu? That's wajib. We're going to go through the wajibah first, then after we do the wajibah, then we'll go through what's mustahab. Yes. Niyyah. What does niyyah mean? Somebody else.
What's niyyah? Intention.
Intention. Okay, so how do you do your intention? What language do you have to say your niyyah in?
Arabic.
Any language? Yeah. Okay. You're stealing her answer. Okay. Anybody else have any ideas? No. Do you have to say your niyyah in words?
Yes. Or
even
no.
Oh, yes, no? See what happens? We disagree about simple laws or English. Alright, let me ask you, did you guys make a niyat before you came to the majlis tonight?
Yeah.
Did you say, I'm going to the majlis to listen to a speech, qurbatan lillah? Did you say that?
No.
No. Did you know where you're going?
Yes.
Yeah. That's what niyat is. Niyat is, you know what you're doing. You don't have to say it. You know in your heart, you know in your mind what's going on. So sometimes the way that we're taught by our parents and by the scholars is we should get in the habit of saying it out loud. That way we're not confused. So I'm not saying don't say it with words, but I want to let everybody know that you don't have to say it with words. In Arabic, it's a good thing if you can learn the Arabic. And you know, sometimes like my parents, they told me to say it in Urdu. I had no idea what they were telling me, but and I was like, minamas partum, wadu kartum, okay, no problem. But I didn't really understand it until I said, okay, what does niyat actually mean? Niyat means just know what you're about to do. And how do we know what we're about to do? Let's say you're making wudu, and one of your friends comes up to you and is like, you know, what are you doing? So you have two choices. Either you can say, I have no idea. If you have no idea, that means you didn't have a niyat. You had no intention. You have no idea what's going on. Or if you have niyat, then you'll say, well, I'm making wudu because I'm about to go pray salat, or I'm doing it just because it's a good thing to do. Right? Is that clear? Or is there any other issues about that?
You say, I'm
doing it
because it's a good thing to
do. Well, that's a good point. Everything that we do we have to make sure it's qurbatan illallah. And that means that it's so we're trying to get closer to Allah. We can't make wudu or, well, I'm doing this so that my parents are really, really proud of me. You can't even do that. I can't do this because I want to show up to the mullah. You can't do that either. The only reason you can do anything in life is to please Allah, to make sure that you're getting close to Him. And that's it. That's the only niyat we can have. Because anything else means that somebody else has become your God. And remember what we said. When we say La ilaha illallah, Allah is our only God, nothing else in life. Good? Okay. So now we've got niyat down, I hope, inshallah. So after niyat, what's next? Come on, you guys make wudu all the time. You know what to do. No? Okay, I'll go through it. So, sorry.
Like, wash your face twice.
Wash your face twice, okay. How many times? Is twice wajib? Or is it recommended? You know?
I'm guessing it's recommended.
Oh, it's a good guess. Very good. So, again, like I said, I want to go through the wajib wudu first. Then I'll go back and we'll do the mustahab. Now, am I saying, when I do this, to stick to the wajib? Absolutely not. If we want to be real Shia of the Imam, if we want to be real Shia of Muhammad, we Shia of Ali, we Shia of the Imam of the time, what we need to do is make sure we go above and beyond everything. Some people, when they hear mustahab, what they think is, oh, it's just recommended. You know, you don't have to do it. It's just, you get extra sawab. But that's actually not the case. What mustahab really means is it's just like wajib. Wajib means that Allah has made an order for you. You have to do this. Mustahab is the same thing. Allah makes an order that you have to do this. This is Allah that I'm telling you. The difference between wajib and mustahab is this. Wajib, if you don't do it, then you get guna. You've sinned, so you'll get punishment for it. Mustahab, Allah, because of His mercy, says, if you don't do it, even though I commanded you, I won't give you a punishment. But if you do it, then I'll give you extra rewards for it. So obviously, we don't know if we're going to heaven or hell. We don't know what kind of people we are in life. So why wouldn't we want to go for that extra credit? You know, wouldn't it be arrogant for somebody to say, I'm okay, the wajib is enough for me. We should always make sure we go above and beyond, right? So, let's go through the wajib first so we have an understanding, and then we'll go back and do the mustahabat. But before that, send Allah salawat. So, as he said, rightfully, that the first thing that's wajib after niyat is we wash our faces. So what's the amount that we wash? You know, some people just take it and you know, they slap their face. That's not it. What they say is, you start with a palm span. So it starts from the end of your middle finger all the way to the end of your thumb. So you stretch it out like this. So you take a little bit of that water, or you know, you wash your hand in the water, or you know, from a bowl, however you want to do it. And then you start at the top of your forehead, right, you know, right below your hair, and you just go straight down all the way. Make sure, again, you go a little bit under your chin so that you get all of your face. And then, after that, you want to make sure that you get all the parts that you missed. So, with that same water in your hand, you know, just move through all these parts that you probably didn't get when you went all the way through. So, like the end part of your eyes, or under your nose, this or that. But one thing you have to make sure is when we're doing this, always go downward. Never side to side, and never upward. If you do that, then it's a problem. You can't do that in wudu.
Because when you do side to side, it goes in these parts of your hair. When you go up, it goes up in here.
Right, so you always have to be going down. So just remember that. Now some people say, again, we said that wajib is only once. So the question is, alright, if I have water and I keep wiping, how many times is that? Is that as many times as I wipe? Again, this is all about niyyah. So if you take water once and you go like this, and then you do this a few more times, you call that your first wash. And that's what's wajib for you. Then once you're done with that, then you move on to the next part. And what's next after your face? Go ahead. It's mustahab to do the nose, but that's actually before that. Yes.
Your hands?
Your arms, yeah. We'll take that. That's good enough. So, you take, again, we're doing the wajib. It's somehow you get the water onto above your elbow and your right hand, and you go all the way down. So the first thing we do is we start on this side, or the outside of your elbow. For men, and for women, you start on the inside. So you start that way, you put your hand, you go all the way through, and then you flip to the other side, and you go all the way through. And again, to make sure we get everything, you know, wipe a few times, make sure you get in between your fingers. But again, just like with your face, make sure you're always going down, never go upwards. We don't do that. And also, make sure you don't move your arm. It's your hand with the water that goes down on your arm. You can hold your hand any way you want, side to side, up, down, whatever. So you can do this too if you want to. But just always make sure your hand is doing it, and it's like, I mean, this doesn't look like it's going down. That's why I'm saying down like this. Make sense?
Yeah?
Okay. So then after this arm, you go to your next arm, you take the water, you do the same thing. If you're a male, if you're a man, you start outside of the elbow, above it, and you go all the way down, make sure you get those parts. you flip over to the other side, and you do that. And again, if you're women, you start on the inside, and then you flip over. Okay, so we finished the niyat, we did our face, we did the arms. Now what's next? Yes?
Do your forehead?
Yes, you do your forehead. Okay, do I take extra water?
No.
No, you don't. So after you do your arms, you have to make sure you don't touch any more water. If you do, then the wudu is not going to count. So with the water that's left over in your hands, this is where you do your wiping. So where on your head do you wipe? Can you do it in the back? Can you do it on the sides? Now where does it have to be?
On the forehead.
Yeah. So what we have to do is kind of imagine like, you know, you're making a diagram of your head and it's like in four parts. So this is like part one, this is part two, this is part three, and this like top thing is part four. So part four is really the only part you're allowed to wipe in. Now which way can you go? Do you have to go backwards, forward, side to side? Yeah.
Forward.
Is it right?
No.
And which way?
This way.
This way? You can do any way.
Oh.
Yeah. You can go down, you can go up, you can even go side to side if you want. The way that they define that, the wiping, we're saying what's wajib. I didn't say what's mustahab yet. What's wajib is that you have to do something that's a wipe. That if somebody else was looking at you and they say, you know, this kid looks like he's wiping his head. So you can't be like that. You have to make sure it's some sort of wiping in, you know, whatever direction. Like for me, since I put my hair back, I usually go back. But that's not mustahab. Again, we'll get to the mustahab afterwards. So, you know, you want to go side, do that. You want to go up and down, whatever. Now, some mujtahids also say that if you have long hair, and it's hair that's long enough that if you brush it down, it goes, like, you know, onto your face. You know, like, my hair used to be even longer than yours, actually. So if that's the case, some of the mujtahids say that what you should make sure and do is part a little bit of your hair so you can get that water into your scalp. I'm sorry, I'm looking at you because I don't see anybody else with too much hair around you. But so make sure that it gets into the scalp. And again, you can go up, down, whatever way you want. And then after our forehead, after our head, one more. What's left? What's the last part? Yes?
The feet.
The feet, okay. So, yeah.
After the feet?
Then what? After the feet? There's nothing. And you leave, you get out of the bathroom now. Okay. So the feet, again, we don't go for extra water. We take whatever water we still have in our hand. Even after we wipe our forehead, we still have to use that extra, the water that's still in our hand. So, where do we start? We start at the tips of our toes over here. And you start at the base. And what's wajib is only that you need to do one finger's worth. You don't need to do your whole hand, just one finger's worth. So let's say I did just the wajib. So I have the wetness in my index finger. I start at the top. And I come down, and I go all the way up. How far do I go? Well, they say above the ankle, a little bit above that ankle. That little, it's called garaba, the ankle, really. But it's that, you know, that bone part that sticks out. You try to go above that. That's where you want to stop. So then after your right foot, you switch over to the left, and then do the same thing. Now, remember I had said the rules about not moving your... You can move your hand down for your arm, you just can't move your arm, right? Remember that? Now that same rule applies for everything else after your after the arm. So for your head, only your hand can move. You can't like shake your head and do that. And same thing with the feet. The feet, you can't move your feet. They have to be stationary. And your hand has to be doing the moving. Is that clear? Yeah? Okay. So now that's it. That's the wajib of the wudu. So everything was only done once. Now let's go back and let's say what's mustahab. What's mustahab is doing everything twice. But again, let's start from the beginning. So you make your niyat. And some scholars even say that saying your niyat in your head or saying it out loud can be mustahab. And there's all these du'as that are recommended to recite before it. So if you want to get in the habit of it, have your parents print out something. You can find it online. And have that print out with you while you're making wudu. And get in the habit of reading it. So, if you don't, you know, have all those du'as yet, then the simple thing to start with is, you know, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Make your niyat and start. So the first mustahabat that you can do is what? Before, again, this is after your niyat. Before you wash your face, what's the first mustahab after wudu? Your hands. And they differ on how many times, but usually two or three, something like that is okay. So again, just hands like around the wrist and down. Just wash them, you know, get them clean. After you're done with that, what's next?
Do your nose or no your mouth?
It's the head.
Well, it's a part of your face, yeah. The mouth, right? You gargle water. So you gargle water. No. Again, some say two, some say three times. Then after mouth, then what do we have?
Nose.
And I mean, I know it's mustahab, but for me that's the weirdest thing, to like sniff water in my nose. I've been doing it for a while and I still can't get used to it. But you're supposed to kind of snort the water in your nose and like snort it out. I know it sounds kind of gross, but apparently it's supposed to clean your nose out, alright? So you should do it. It's mustahab. Again, they say two or three times. So after that, now we're done with the initial mustahabah in the face. Now we said, one time is wajib. The second time, like the brother said, is mustahab. What about if we want to do it a third time? Can I do it? Can I be extra clean if I do that?
No.
No? Yes? No? Maybe?
Maybe so.
Maybe so? Maybe not. No, definitely not. Three times is haram. Three times is haram. Now, it doesn't make your wudu batin, but it's a sin for you to do that. Now, again, this is if you consider it to be a third. Like we said, if you take that water, let's say, you know, you have your sink running. So you have the water in your hand, and then you wipe your face down that one wash of time. Then, if you keep wiping with that same water, then you can consider that one wash. Then you can take some more water, do that same thing, keep going down, and you can consider that number two. Just because you take water a bunch of times doesn't make it three. It's all in your intention. If you say, I'm taking water over and over again, but this is only one wash, that's all you need. But again, to make sure that we're okay, when you take water one time, use that as the first wash, wipe as many times as you feel necessary, and once you're okay, then take water again, and then make that your second one. Then make sure you realize that's mustahab. Remember, it's two, not three. Never do three, that's sin, that's quran. Okay? Any confusion there? It seems like it, but nobody's asking questions, so I guess we'll go on. So again, yes?
Isn't the mouth second?
The mouth second?
Mm-hmm.
What's first?
The face. Isn't the mouth the second?
No, what's first is when you're doing your washing, the mustahab stuff, is that you wash your hands, then after your hands, then you gargle water, and then after you gargle water, then you istinshaq, which is snorting water and getting it, you know, snorting it out, whatever you want to call it. So that's, and then you do the face. Okay? Okay, so now we've done our face twice, right? Alright, so now we're continuing on our mustahab wudu. So we've done our face twice. Now we go to the arms. Again, arms, same thing. Arms is mustahab to do. You know, you get the water once. But one thing I forgot to mention before. It's mustahab to take the water in your right, put it in your left, and then move it over your right arm. So once you do that, that's considered one. You consider that your one wash. And then you do it one more time, and then put the water in, and then that's it. Now you have two. Don't do it again, only two. And then you do the same thing. You take the water in your right. You have your first wash on your arm. Take the water again. You have your second wash on your arm. And that's it. Now you're done. Now again, we have to make sure we don't go for any more water after we do our arms. Move on to the forehead. And again, going downwards is mustahab. Although you can do any way, the best way is to go downwards. But make sure again that you don't move your head, that you're moving your hands. And like we had said, with the feet, what's wajib was one finger. But what's mustahab is that you get your whole hand and always. Oops. So you start with the right, you go down there with your whole hand and go above, and then the same thing after the left. And then you're done. Right? Any parts unclear? Probably nobody wants to say anything. That's okay. No problem. So two other points that we want to mention that sometimes we don't hear all the time. Wudu, why do we do wudu? Yes.
To make sure we're not
religious. Wudu doesn't take care of najasa. That's not true. Yes. Very good. Is that it? Yes.
To spiritually purify yourself.
Very good, very good. You got a little out of here. Very nice. Okay. So, wudu, yes, you need it before you pray namaz. Otherwise, your namaz doesn't count, right? But at the same time, wudu is called, it's called nur, it's called light. And when you keep making wudu, even if you don't need to, the Prophet has said that this is nur ala nur. It's light on top of light. One way we can think about it is, imagine like a cop or a soldier going out in the battlefield. If you want, you can wait till you go out and, you know, then you put on your armor when you're in the middle of the battlefield. Or you can put on before you go out. Or you can keep it on all the time just in case to keep yourself safe. So wudu is kind of like a spiritual armor that we can put on. So it's recommended that we're always in the state of wudu. And there's lots of ahadith that tell us why we should do that. And there's many protections. Some, you know, some people who are, you know, one thing they say is that it protects you against jinn and black magic and things like that. Other people say that it helps with your memorization. It'll increase your, you know, your memory capacity. It'll keep you focused. And they even say when you're studying, before you study, you should make wudu. So we're told to do this, so we should get in the habit of doing this. So, you know, typically we wake up in the morning, and we're not in wudu obviously, because when we sleep, we break wudu. The first thing we should learn to do is go immediately to the bathroom, you know, while we're brushing our teeth and we're done with that. Make wudu right away. So now you start your day off with spiritual armor on. And let's say in the middle of the day you have to use the bathroom. After you use the bathroom and you purify yourself properly, make wudu again. There's no harm in it, and it'll only protect you against the attacks of shaitan. And it'll keep you protected the whole time. And what's, if you want to take it a step even further, is right before the time of salah, even if you're in wudu, make wudu again. Because that means it's extra spiritual protection against shaitan when he tries to attack you in salah. Make sense? Okay. Now there's one more point. Again, we did a lot of fiqh today, and we're going to move on, inshallah, after this last point. Now sometimes, unfortunately, we perform israf in wudu. What's israf? Does anybody know? Israf is, and the fancy word is extravagance, but a simple way to think about it is wastefulness. Now, our scholars, like, you know, our great high up ulama and urafa, you know, these great, you know, spiritual scholars, they say when they make their wudu, they use like little bottle caps to make wudu with. So they get a little bit, you know, bottle caps worth, and that's how much they make wudu with. Anything more, then, you know, they stop. Or they'll fill up a little cup of water and use that to make their wudu. Or they have a bowl of water that they use the whole day. So what do? Unfortunately, we don't have these practices in our country in the West. What do? We turn on the faucet, we just let it run and run and run, and the whole time it's running, then we're making wudu, and water is being wasted the whole time. Now, the ones who are young here don't understand why this is wasteful, because you guys don't pay your water bill. But your parents understand that this adds up. At the same time, we need to understand that this is a gift from Allah. Other countries, other people don't have this kind of water available. We should keep that in mind by making sure that when we're taking the water out, turn on the faucet, take the water that you need, and then turn it off right away. And then move on to the next part. So if we were performing the wudu without israf, it would be like this. So you turn off the, you turn on the water, the faucet, you get your, you know, you wash your hands, and then you turn it off. And you just move the hand, the water around. Ya rahmatullah. Turn it on again, take the water in your hand, in your right hand, turn it off, and then wipe your face, and then keep wiping. If you want to go for a second time, turn it on again, put your hand in the faucet, and turn it off right away, and then keep going. And for every point that you're not going to be using the water directly, turn off the faucet. Make sense? Is that confusing at all? Uh-oh. So, that was just a few things that we wanted to go through, and inshallah, if there's any other things that were yes?
A quick question on that.
Sure.
When you're not supposed to take any more water, when you're doing your masah, if you turn the tap off, you lose some of the water.
That's true.
Are you allowed to do that?
Well, there's, again, if we keep that practice of turning it on and off, then we wouldn't have to go back to the faucet, you know, if we were doing that, right? That's one thing.
Right, but after you do, let's say, your hands.
So after you do your hands, right.
And then now you have to use the same water for masah.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as you took the water.
The water was already off.
Yeah.
Now see, one problem, one second, is sometimes if the water's still running after we do this arm, then some people will then turn it off and then do mas. If you do that, there might be some water on the faucet. So what happens? If there's water on that faucet and you put your hand on there, now you have extra water. And now when you do your mas and your feet, there's a possibility that your wudu doesn't count now because you use extra water. So that's why we're told to keep it on and off and make sure that by the time you're doing your left arm, that you never have to touch water again. Now, sometimes we wipe so much, or maybe we didn't take enough water, that after we do our left arm, we're, you know, it gets very, very dry. So if that's the case, they say you can take water from your arms or your face, or you don't have a beard, but for the men, you know, you take it from your beard. And you can use that to make everything else. And if you don't have enough from at least your arms or your face, then you have to go back and do your wudu again. Because if there's so much of a gap in time that your hands or your face have dried up, then you have to go back and redo all the wudu. Does that answer? Yeah? Okay.
Does sheepskin also get najis
when you it? It follows the same rule as the cow thing. Anything that we're allowed to eat, basically, that has not been slaughtered properly, is considered, you know, if we come in contact with it, with wetness, it will become najis on us. I mean, you can wear, like, wool and all those things, But if there's wetness that transfers, then you have a problem. Right? So again, try to get a Muslim sweater or something. No, don't. So if there's no questions, inshallah, then we're going to move on to the history and then to the Sa'ib, inshallah. You can send a loud salawat.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad.
Again, just as a final reminder, if any of the issues that we go through are unclear, or if there's any other things that you guys are still confused about, even if it's not related to what we talk about, you can come to me afterwards or come to me before. You know, I'm here for a few more minutes after the lecture, not too long, but, you know, come with these questions and inshallah we'll try to answer them. And inshallah we'll get to the question that the sister posed. So, there's one verse of Quran I want to read before we move on. So this is from chapter 61, verse 14. This verse says, Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, become helpers of Allah. Become helpers of Allah, just like Jesus, the son of Mary, peace be upon him, said to his disciples, Who are my helpers in the cause of God? Who are my helpers in the cause of Allah? And his disciples, the disciples of Jesus, said, We are the helpers of Allah. Nahnu ansar Allah. So why am I reading this verse to you? This verse, again, it's saying, Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who have iman. So this is addressed to a specific type of person. So you might think that this means, you know, Shia specifically, because, you know, we're the ones who want to try to have true iman. And without wilayat, then your iman is not complete. But you notice here that Allah is saying, become helpers, become ansarullah, just like the Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him, had said to his disciples. So, does that mean that only Shias can have that answer, can answer the call of Allah, can be helpers of Allah? No. What we will go into tonight is we'll find that there was other people present at Karbala who helped Imam Hussein. And this person, his name is Wahab al-Kalbi. And him and his family belonged to a Christian tribe. And they were present at Karbala. So whenever we get in discussions, if we ever do, with, you know, our friends who might be Christian, for example, and they, you know, they wonder, you know, why do you guys make such a big deal at Karbala? Say, well, Karbala is not just for Shia. It's not just for Muslims. It's for all of humanity. It's a representation of injustice, and the people who fought against injustice were all present there. Whether they were Shia, whether they were different school of Islamic thought, even those who were Christian were present. And there's plenty of other individuals. But tonight, we want to focus on this person who was following the religion according to, you know, Christianity. So he was a follower of the Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him. So, when we understand, and many of you have heard this, when the Imam, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, had made that call at Karbala, when he had said, is there anybody there to help me? Just like Allah saying here, where are my helpers? Where are Ansarullah? This person, Wahab ibn Kalbi, Wahab al-Kalbi, this Christian answered that call. He didn't let his beliefs of Christianity get in the way. In fact, because of his love, his true love for the Prophets, and we'll get into tomorrow more of a discussion on the Prophets. Because of his true love and his open heart and his open mind, he was able to see what the truth was. And he saw that the truth was with Hussein. The truth was on his side, not on the side of Yazid, not on the side of Umar ibn Sa'd. Inshallah, now we're going to go into a little bit of his history. If you can send one loud last salawat. So, as we said, that Wahab belonged to the Kalbi tribe, and this was a Christian tribe. So his father, his mother, his wife, everybody, they were all Christian. So Wahab had just gotten married, and he was very, very young. They say that in the history books that he was about 17, and that his wife was maybe 12, 13, something like that. And that might sound a little strange to us, but, you know, back then it was normal for people to get married that young because they matured much faster. Not like some of us, where we take 20, 30, 40 years sometimes to mature. But so he had just gotten married, and he was on his way back from his honeymoon. So he's passing through the different parts of Iraq, and he's with his wife, and he's with his mother. So along the way, they come across Imam Hussein alayhi salam, who at this point is coming towards Kufa. And this is before he was stopped on his way to Karbala. So he stopped, and along the way, this Christian and his family, they hear what's going on. They hear some of the sermons that the Imam is giving. And he says that, you know, this sounds really interesting. This doesn't sound like an average person. This person, this Hussein, who he had found out was the grandson of the Holy Prophet. So this person has this way of speaking, like there's a light within him. You know, I've never seen or heard of this before. And he had went back to his mother and he had told him about it. And he said, you know, I'm feeling something different about this guy. And so his mom said, well, what do you want to do? He said, I think I need to join him. You know, I think that his mission is going against injustice. And we as Christians, that's what the Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him, that's what he did. In his time, he stood up against the unjust people of the time. He said, so if we were to be proper Christians, we would stand up, we'd stand with Hussein. And his mom said, you're absolutely right. But his wife, because they were newlyweds, he didn't like this. She didn't like this. Why? Because she's like, you know, why do you want to go with him to this battle? Why do you want to fight? We just got married, you know, that's not your fight. It's for Muslims, it's not for you. But he was trying to, Wahab and his mother were trying to tell the wife, this is a fight against injustice. This is a fight for truth. No matter who we are, we have to stand with Hussein because he's standing with truth. Because this is what the Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him, this is what he would have done. So they start traveling with the Imam. And now, they're at Karbala. Now at Karbala, he's paying close attention to what's going on. And he sees that what treatment is the Imam getting and what treatment is Umar ibn Sa'd doing to the Imam. And he notices that water has been cut off. That food, everything's been cut off for the Imam and his family. And he sees this and this solidifies. This just makes him feel even more certain that these guys, this Umar ibn Sa'd, this Shimr, Ibn Ziyad, Yazid, all these guys, they're in the wrong. So I need to stand for the truth. I need to stand with the Imam. And now we're getting closer to Karbala and we're close to Ashura. And he's with the Imam. And he finally comes to the Imam and says, Imam, I want permission to fight on your behalf. I want permission. I want you to let me, give me ijazah, give me your blessing. Let me go out and fight for you. Because fighting for you is for truth. Fighting for you is justice. And the Imam says, no, you just got married. Stay back, take your family, and you know, go. You guys are Christian, this is not your fight. This is a fight for Muslims. See, brothers and sisters, the Imam wasn't forcing people with him. He wasn't saying, oh, you Muslims, come with me, let's go fight. He was trying to get rid of people as much as possible. He didn't want people to come and die with him. But this is the type of followers that he had. They were so dedicated that they stuck with him, even knowing that they would die in battle. So, Wahab pleads. He says, please, I want to die with you. I want to die as a martyr for you. And Imam says, I can't let you do that. And this is a jihad. This is a war for Muslims only. So, Wahab says, if that's the case, then ashhadu an la ilaha illallah wa ashhadu anna muhammadar rasulullah. He says, I testify that there is no God except Allah. And I testify that Muhammad is his prophet. And there he became Muslim. And then after this, then the Imam kissed him and he said, now you are Muslim. Now you can fight for me. And then he went back and he told his mother and his wife about this. And his mother said, if you're going to be Muslim because of this, if this is truth, then I'm going to be Muslim as well. And she said the same thing. Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah wa ashhadu anna Muhammadar Rasulullah. And they both recognized the Imam as the Imam of the time. And they said, we have to fight for him. So now he has permission. Now he's going out to fight. But his wife still doesn't like this idea. And his wife is trying to hold him back. Say, we just got married. Don't do this. This is not a good idea. But when somebody has yaqeen in the truth, brothers and sisters, when somebody has real iman, nothing can stop them from doing what they know Allah has commanded them to do. So Wahab goes out to battle. And he fights valiantly. And the whole time, his mother is chanting for him and saying, get up, son. Defend the grandson of the Prophet of God. And Wahab says, definitely, I'll never be stingy with my fighting. So he comes out and he makes sure everybody in the battlefield knows that he used to be Christian and he changed himself and now he's a Muslim and he's fighting on behalf of the Imam. And he says, if you don't know me, I'm from the tribe of Qalb. And soon you'll see me and you'll see my sword. And you'll see my attack and the way I act in battle. And I'm going to seek the revenge of my companions, the ones who you've already killed. And there will be no grief and there will be no affliction after my grief or before my grief. And fighting me in the battlefield is no joke. Because they were making jokes about him in the battlefield. They were saying he's only 17, he doesn't know what he was doing. So then he started doing all these tricks on his horses so that people knew who he was. And then finally they said, we can't do this anymore. So they sent soldier after soldier after him to kill him. So then he went forward and he attacked the Kufan army. And he killed one after the other after the other. And then he goes back to his mom in the middle of battle. And he says, mother, are you pleased? Am I making you happy? And his mother says, I will not be pleased until you attain martyrdom, until you die in the presence of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And then his wife says, please, by the name of Allah, don't make me cry over you. Don't die. Don't leave me. I'm going to be a widow. I don't want that. And the mother continued and tried to convince him. Says, oh son, don't accept what she's saying. Go fight in the way of the grandson of the Prophet, so that on the day of judgment, he'll be your shafa, he'll intercede for you. So Wahab came, and he came back, and he fought again. And he was struck with spears, he was struck with the sword, he was struck with arrows, but he kept on going. And he killed more people and more. And he kept coming back and forth, always asking his mom, are you pleased with me? Have I done enough? And she said, no, you're not dead yet. You haven't died for Hussein. Keep going back. And again, the wife was saying, don't go. But he was valorous, and he was true. He knew what he was fighting for. So he kept going out. So then, after a while, he got tired of battle. The wounds were getting very deep. And then the wounds became fatal. And he had killed many horsemen, he had killed even more soldiers, but finally, he had died. And they cut his head off. And at this point, when the wife had seen this, then she cried. And then she came to the Imam and said, Imam, O Hussein, if I let you give permission to Wahab to die in the battlefield, will you promise me one thing? And he says, what is it? He says, will you promise me that you won't let him go to heaven without me? And she says, yes, I promise this to you. So Imam made the promise that both of you will go to heaven together. So then she says, okay. Then she takes the shahada. She becomes Muslim. She says, Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah wa ashhadu anna Muhammadan Rasulullah. You see how the Imam takes care of everybody, all those in his group, and how everybody comes to Islam, no matter what their background is. So now Wahab is dead. They kill him, they cut his head off, and they throw it back to his mother. And the mother takes this and says, we don't take these, this is a gift for Allah, this is a gift for the Imam. And she throws the head back. And they say, may Allah reward you favorably due to what you've done for my family. And the Imam is pleased. He says, return back. And having heard this, the wife of Wahab jumps on the body of her husband, and she starts crying and crying, and she tries to wipe the blood away. And when Shimr saw this, he commanded his people to go strike her with a club. So a person came and struck her with a club in the back of the head. And this is how the wife of Wahab became the first woman to become shaheed for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Ala la'natullah ala qawm al-zalameen wa sayya'ilu min al-zina zalamu ayyabun qalabin yan qalabun inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un raban bi qadahi wa tasliman li amri. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.